O fortuna, velut luna statu variabilis. Semper crescis aut decrescis vita detestabilis. Nunc ob durat et tunc curat, ludo mentis atiem egestatem potestatem dissolvit ut glaciem. By these verses, Karl Orff opens his Carmina Burana. This is the name usually given to a manuscript of poems and dramatic texts, mostly from the 11th or 12th century, a selection of which Orff has set to music in the 30s of the last century. In spite of the poem's rhetorical brilliance and its potential correspondence to human experience, it should not be forgotten that the text had been composed by a clergyman whose religious convictions include the belief in an almighty, omniscient and omnibenevolent God. But how does the portrait of fortune, as painted in the second stanza of our poem, fit with this Christian belief? Sors imanis et inanis rota tu volubilis, status malus vana salus semper dissolubilis, otumbrata et velata mihi quoc veniteris, nunc per ludum dorsum nudum ferro tui sceleris. How does fortune's malevolence and villainy uncompromisingly expressed in these lines be compatible with the almighty God of salvation? Or to put it in more general terms, how could the polytheistic goddess of fortuna survive in Christian monotheism? This question is intriguing me for a number of years already, and it is thanks to the generous invitation to this international consortium for research that I got the opportunity to think a bit more systematically about this problem. Therefore, all I can do this evening is to present you some interim results of my research. In my talk, I will predominantly refer to the first key term of our consortium, namely fate, though the question of free will also play a certain part. I will try to give an answer to two questions, the first of which I have cited already. How could fortune, a remnant of antique polytheism, survive in a world deeply determined by Christian monotheism? My second question addresses the effects of this, at first sight, nothing but unlikely integration of fortune into a Christian worldview. Which consequences did this assimilation of fortune entail for Christian belief itself? And as we shall see in the long run, it brought about considerable change for a Christian interpretation of creation and nature, changes that challenged the basic teachings of Christianity. One of the reasons apt to explain the survival of fortuna might be its intellectual attraction. In my opinion, the cognitive appeal of the figure of fortune, to a great extent, relies on the possibility to explain those living conditions which man is unable to control himself in terms of human behavior. With the help of fortuna, the ephemeral character of prosperity or the fragility of wealth or health in human life can be reduced to the fickleness, the blindness, or the envy of fortune. That is to say, the figure of fortune enables men to rationalize the limits of human agency in terms of human agency. Thanks to fortune, the loss of factual power over life in a way is outweighed and minimized by a gain of intellectual control. However, these advantages offered by the figure of fortune in antiquity are fundamentally incompatible with a Christian worldview. The monotheistic belief in an omniscient and mostly omnibenevolent God radically excludes the assumption of his blindness or envy. And a monotheistic worldview also makes it impossible to assume the existence of any power that is independent from the Almighty God. It was Lactantius who clearly stated the incompatibility of the figure of fortune with any idea of deity. Stultitia igitur et error et cecitas, et ut Cicero aet ignoratio rerum atque causarum Nature ac fortune nomina induxit. Obviously, the early church father, still struggling for intellectual acknowledgement of Christian faith in a predominantly pagan context, is happy to be able to invoke Cicero, an authority of ancient philosophy, to support his argument. Therefore, the conclusion he draws regarding fortune consequently is and must be radical. Fortuna ergo per se nihil est. Nec sic habendum est tamquam sit in aliquo sensu. Lactantius' argument, with some variation, is repeated by St. Augustine. In the City of God, he too uncompromisingly stated the nothingness of fortune, pointing to her basic inconsistency. Ubi est igitur definitio illa fortune? Ubi est quota fortuitis etiam nomen accipit? Nihil enigma potest eam colere, si fortuna est, si autem suus cultores discernit ut prosit, fortuna non est. Yet, in spite of all these undoubtedly convincing arguments, the criticism of fortuna, as our example from Carmina Burana paradigmatically proved, did not prevail and could not prevent the ongoing presence of this deeply pagan figure in a substantially Christian culture. Why then did she survive? An attempt to answer to this question has to take into account the reception of an important text from late antiquity, widely spread and frequently referred to in the Middle Ages, namely the Consolatio Philosophiae, written by Boethius. Its author himself had brutally experienced the effects of fortune, the unexpected and swift change from prosperity to misery, from the heights of power in the kingdom of the Ostrogoths to jail. Consolation of Philosophy was composed by Boethius during his imprisonment, while he was awaiting trial and eventual horrific execution by Theodoric the Great himself, who suspected him of conspiring with the Eastern Roman Empire. The enormous success of the Consolatio Philosophiae throughout the Middle Ages, however, was largely due to a misinterpretation. Boethius' treatise was regarded as a document of Christian faith. Yet, even though reverence is often made to God, the book is not strictly religious. There is no reference made to Jesus Christ or Christianity, other than a few oblique references to Pauline scripture, such as the symmetry between the opening lines of Book 4, Chapter 3, and a passage from the first letter to the Corinthians. God is, however, represented not only as an eternal and all-knowing being, but as the source of all good. If nonetheless the text, despite its surprisingly few explicit references to the gospel, has been widely received as a Christian text, this reading proves to what extent the syncretism of late antique thought is compatible with Christian teaching. Boethius's consolation is predominantly based on Stoic philosophy. Mainly, its book 2 is devoted to a discussion of the nature of fortune, who in Stoic thinking traditionally represents the opponent of virtue. It is therefore by a contingent factor, by misreading a deeply Stoic tractate, that fortune plays an important part in a seemingly Christian text. The traditional portrait of fortune, the specific qualities with which fortuna is credited throughout the Middle Ages, are largely based on Boethius' characteristics of this figure. In this connection, the specific ontological status of fortune deserves our special interest. On closer consideration, fortune in the Consolation of Philosophy is situated on two different levels of reality. On the one hand, the term fortuna denotes a number of objects of the phenomenal world. The realm of fortune is, according to a classification of goods developed in Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, the external goods, wealth, fame, honor, and power, and the goods of the body, health, good looks, physical strength, athletic ability, dexterity, etc. With his major intention in the Consolation of Philosophy is to thoroughly demonstrate the substantial lack of any value of these goods. Nobody else than philosophy herself explains to Boethius the cause of his unhappiness, uncompromisingly states. Si penitus egretunis tua causas habitum quo cognovi, fortune prioris affectu desiderio quo tabestis, ea tantum animi tui sicuti tu tibi fingis mutata pervertit, intellego multiformes illius prodigi fucus, et eo usque quam his quo eludere nititur blandissimam familiaritatem, dum intolerabili dolore confundat, quos insperata reliquerit. Cuius in naturam mores ac meritum reminiscare, nec habuisse te in ea pulchrum aliquid, nec amisisse cognosces. In sum, all goods of fortune are valueless. The possession or the loss of them does not have any substantial importance for man's happiness, which is exclusively based on his living in harmony with reason. Yet not only philosophy in the Consolation Philosophiae takes the floor, Fortuna herself does also. She too acts in this text as an allegory of herself, as philosophy passes the floor to her. An ego sola meum ius exercere prohibebur, licet celo proferre lucidus dies eos demque tenebrosis noctibus condere, licet anno terre vultum nunc floribus frugibus quo retimire, nunc nimbis frigoribus quo confundere, ius est mare nunc strato equore blandiri, nunc procellis ac fluctibus in horresceres, nos ad constantiam nostris moribus alienam expleta hominum cupiditas alligabit, hec nostra vis est hunc continuum ludum ludimus rotam, volubile orbe versamus inferma summis summa infirmis mutare gaudemus. Ascendesi placet sed ea legene uticum ludicri mei ratio, posset dissensere injuriam potes, antu mores ignorabas meos, nestiebas croesum regum ludorum Cyro Paulo anto formidabile mox de inde miserandum rogi flammis traditum miso celitis imbre defensum. By her words, Fortune does nothing else than justifying her traditional qualities. Whoever complains about her ignores her nature, and everyone who had deliberately got involved with her should have known her character when he did so. Yet, perhaps more important than the arguments she brings forward is the very fact of her self-explication. Fortuna, the embodiment of contingency, the lack of any rational coherence or causality nonetheless, claims for her transparency, for the conclusiveness of her acting. That is to say, she ultimately presupposes the rationality of her existence. What is more, she justifies her character by drawing a parallel between her acting and the general conditions of nature. If the goods of fortune are ephemeral, the sky too alternates between brightness and darkness. This way, fortune's claim for the rationality of her behavior is paralleled by a claim for the naturalness of her character. This is, as we shall see in what follows, perhaps the most momentous implication of her self-representation in Boethius' text in the context with Dante. We'll come back to especially this aspect. As I had cited before, the term fortuna in the Consolation of Philosophy operates on two different levels. On the one hand, it designates a number of objects and conditions of man's life, the so-called external goods and the goods of body, which are regarded as empirical manifestations of fortune. On the other hand, fortune appears as an allegorical representation of herself. In this regard, her status is rhetorical. That is to say, the general notion of fortune in Boethius' Consolation of Philosophy has no other than a rhetorical status. Ontologically, only the single manifestations of fortune, material goods, health, or beauty, have an empirical factual status. From an historical point of view, it might be correct to assume that the rhetorical allegory of Fortune is a sort of remnant of her former existence as a goddess of the polytheistic Olympus. Yet she is no more than a rhetorical remnant, which does not presuppose any factual existence. Consequently, the figure of Fortune in the constellation of philosophy relies on an ontological paradox. Although the rhetorical allegory of Fortune ascribes to her a set of general qualities, only the single empirical manifestations of Fortune can be called factual. Hence, the general notion of Fortune in Boethius' treatise constitutes a sort of ontological gap. Owing to a quite productive misreading, the interpretation of Boethius as a Christian text established the figure of Fortune in a Christian worldview. Yet this integration is confined to a merely factual or phenomenal one. What is still lacking is a conceptual integration, for the incompatibility between the almighty and omnibenevolent God and the almost partly malicious Fortune persists. Even the factual, widely contingent reception of a text that misleadingly was received as a document of Christian faith does not abolish the discrepancies between the remnant of a pagan goddess and the God of the Gospel. Why, then, did Fortune survive? The answer to this question might eventually be found in a text that, with greater radicalism than any text before, integrated the figure of Fortune into a Christian perspective. And it is presumably the very radicalism itself of this attempt to fully integrate her into Christian cosmology which allows for the insight into the hidden reasons of Fortune's survival. The text I'm referring to is the seventh canto of the Inferno in Dante's Commedia. In quite remarkable verses, Virgil explains the, as he claims, widely unknown nature of Fortune. Colui, lo cui saver tutto trascende, fece li cieli e dielor chi conduce, sì, ogni parte ad ogni parte splende, distribuendo igualmente la luce, similemente agli splendor mondani ordinò, general, ministra e duce, che permutasse a tempi ben vani di gente in gente ed uno in altro sangue, oltre la difensione di segni umani. Perché una gente impera e l'altra langue, seguendo lo giudizio di costei che è occulto come in erba langue. Vostro saver non ha contasto a lei, questa provvede, giudica e persegue suo regno come loro gli altri dei. Le sue permutazioni non hanno triegue, necessità la fa esser veloce, si spesso vien chi vicenda consegue, questa è colei che tanto posta in croce, pur da color che le dovria andar lore, dandole biasmo a torto e mala voce. Ma ella se beata e ciò non ode, con l'altre prime creature lieta, volve sua spera e beata si gode. Interestingly, these verses start off from a reference to the overwhelming superiority of God's mind, which comes to light in the order of creation. From the very beginning, these lines are thus pointing to their critical issue, for the nature of Fortune will be largely defined, as we shall see, by means of a distinction between different levels of intellectual insight. In what follows, Virgil gives a brief account of the Aristotelian cosmology and its Christian reinterpretation. The heavens and the stars, which are located in these heavens, are moved by the angels who receive their commands by reading God's will in his mind. This brief description of the basic principles of the Christian Aristotelian cosmology serves as background for the integration of Fortune into this cosmological order. For in Virgil's account, Fortune turns her wheel in harmony with the rotation of the heavens. There is no difference left between the order of nature and the order of human faith, both now belong to the same natural order. Already in Boethius' Consolation of Philosophy, Fortune justified her behavior by drawing a parallel between her fickleness and the change of brightness and darkness in the sky. But this comparison served to argue for the naturalness of her volatility. On the contrary, in Virgil's words, the very idea of change is largely replaced by the idea of order, and the similarity between fortune and nature is enhanced to Fortuna's belonging to the same natural cosmos in which the angels move the heavens just as fortune turns her wheel. Interestingly, these complete integration of fortune into a Christian cosmology entails a certain paganization of Virgil's language. In verses 86 and 87, he calls Fortuna as well as the angels gods. Questa provvede, giudica e persegue suo regno come I loro gli altri dei. Does fortune's past, does her identity as a former pagan goddess affect the identity of the Christian angels? As we shall see soon, the naturalization of fortune indeed entails considerable consequences for the Christian dogma. But before I will investigate the effects of Dante's reinterpretation of fortune, I will try to give the still missing answer, the answer to the first of my questions, why fortune could survive in a Christian culture. As I had claimed, the radicalism of Dante's solution will offer a hint to the hidden reasons of fortune's survival. Indeed, the very shift from volatility to stability in Virgil's description, the replacement of instability by order in the description of the movement of fortune's wheel, which now follows the rotation of the spheres, call for an explanation, while nonetheless fortune's behavior appears to be unstable, without order, or even malicious. Dante explains this false impression by a distinction between different degrees of insight. Nothing else than man's incapacity to recognize the unfathomable reasons of her distribution of goods, nothing but the deficiencies of human mind produces the illusion of fortune's fickleness, blindness, or even wickedness. Man's attitude towards fortune, therefore, is unfair. She doesn't deserve his blame, which is solely due to the limits of his insight. However, as fortune by Dante is integrated into the movement of the spheres, she too, as the angels, must fulfill God's will. Consequently, it is his unfathomable will which man is unable to recognize. This way, Dante's interpretation of fortune as a ministra Dei and his criticism of man's blame for her behavior, by implication indeed, allows for a critical insight into the plausibility of Fortuna's survival in the world of Christianity. If, with the help of the figure of fortune, Dante intends to ascertain the rationality of those human experiences which seemingly contradict any order, the function of a distinction between fortune and God becomes apparent. For as long as fortune is accountable for human suffering, which lacks transparency, she detracts attention from the Almighty God's universal responsibility. On closer consideration, the supposition of fortune's existence in a Christian world proves a strategy of theodicy. Of course, Christian dogma itself offers an orthodox explication for the existence of sorrow throughout the world, in large part formulated by St. Augustine. Sorrow is punishment. Sorrow is God's response to the fall of man. By his fall, man troubled the order of creation, which is restored by God's punishment of man. But despite the logical consistency of Augustine's argument, there remains a certain lack of plausibility in his justification of human suffering. The logic of his argument is based on the logic of God's justice, but the grace of the God of salvation, the omnibenevolence of the God of the New Testament, to some extent competes with and replaces the justice of God of the Old Testament. In this conflict between the justice of the Almighty and the grace of the omnibenevolent God, we find the ground which makes fortune's survival not only plausible, but even appealing. Of course, as we have largely discussed, the supposition of Fortune's existence is paralleled by the vagueness of her ontological status. Boethius' ontological gap between single empirical manifestations of Fortune and the rhetorical status of the figure of Fortune was a revealing example of that vagueness. And yet, the acceptance of an ontological vagueness of Fortune in some regard seems to be preferable to the acknowledgement of potential deficiencies of God's omnibenevolence. Dante's reinterpretation of Fortuna's role and the radical naturalization of Fortune by her complete integration into the cosmological order of creation obviously constitutes an attempt to overcome the vagueness of her ontological status. But as we shall see, it is paradoxically Dante's ambitious conceptual and ontological integration of Fortune into a Christian worldview which will considerably affect the integrity of Christian dogma and the belief in the almighty and omnibenevolent God. Naturalization is a general trait of the Aristotelian scholastic reinterpretation of Christian dogma, in the footstep of which also Dante redefines the role of Fortune in God's creation. One of the most momentous effects of this general tendency of naturalization is the transformation of the traditional relation between the original order of creation and the status of, or the status of, the fallen world, the status naturae lapsae in scholastic theology. This change becomes perhaps most evident in Thomas Aquinas' analysis of original sin. His most detailed discussion of this concept is to be found in his Questiones Disputate de Malo. Of central importance for his understanding of original sin is the notion of justitia originalis. Est autem considerambum quod primo homini in sua institutione datum fuerat divinitus quodam superat naturale donum scilicet originalis justitia, per quam ratio subdebate Deo et inferioris viris rationes et corpus animae. Hoc autum donum non fuerat datum primo homini ut singulari personae tantum, sed ut quidam principio totius humanae naturae ut scilicet ab eo per originem derivator deriravetur in posteros. It is important to note that Thomas explicitly describes the justitia originalis as a supernatural gift. He also meticulously avoids the term creation, talking instead of institutio. His unmistakable reluctance to use this term most likely is due to the fact that man is given the originalis justitia in addition to the human nature created by God. Thomas explicitly makes a distinction between the nature of man and the originalis justitia given by God's generosity. Ad undicendum, quod originalis justitia fuit supradita primo homini ex liberalitate divina, sed quod huic anime non detur ad Deo, non est ex parte eius, sed ex parte humanae naturae in qua invenitur contrarium prohibens. According to these lines, the justitia originalis obviously does not belong to the humana natura. If God was obliged to give man a supernatural gift in addition to his human nature, the reason for this donation is to be found in an undeniable defect of the humana natura. Creatura ergo rationalis in hoc preeminet omni creature, quod capax est summi boni per divinam visionem et fruitionem, licet ac hoc consequendum naturae proprie principia non sufficiant, sed ad hoc indigeat auxilio divinae gratiae. Sed circa hoc considerandum est, quod necessarium fuit homini aliquot supernaturale auxilium, ratione sue compositionis. Est enim homo compositus ex anima et corpore et ex natura intellectuali et sensibili, quae quam ad modus sisue naturae relinquantur, intellectum aggravant et impediunt, ne libera ad summum fastidium contemplationes perdinire possit. Hoc autem auxilium fuit originalis justitia, per quam mens homines si subterretur Dei, ei subterrentur totaliter inferioris viret et ipsum corpus neque ratio empideretur quo minus posset in Deum tendere. I apologize for the length of this quotation, but these words are critical for a correct understanding of the implicit transformation of traditional dogma in Thomas Aquinas' theology of original sin. It is the complexity of human nature, relying on a combination of different ontological spheres in natura vegetabilis, in natura sensitiva, and in natura rationalis, that makes necessary a divine gift, a divine auxilium to help reason to impose its superiority over all other human forces. Without any supernatural help, reason obviously lacks power. The perhaps most important result of Thomas' analysis, therefore, lies in the fact that human nature itself, as a consequence of its composition out of different ontological spheres, becomes defective. This basic inherent flaw of human nature is of particular importance for the consequences of original sin. Original sin, in Thomas Aquinas' view, is nothing else than the loss of justitia originalis, and as a result of this loss, human nature is left to itself. Sed quia per peccatum primi parentis ut unfraditetur natura est sibi relicta, subtracto super naturali dono quod homini divinutus erat collatum. If as a result of original sin, human nature is left to itself, the status of fallen man too must be a status naturae. This consequence of Thomas' analysis brings about a momentous transformation of traditional concepts of moral theology. For it is no longer possible to simply identify the condition of fallen man as a status naturae lapse, as Augustine did. The most important change of traditional concepts of original sin in Thomas Aquinas' theology, therefore, consists in a naturalization of fallen man. Even under these conditions, the status of man remains a status naturae, for human nature, though defective, is not distorted, but it is left to itself. Scholastic theology itself seems to shrink from the consequences that result from this transformation of traditional dogma. On the contrary, Boccaccio's De Camerone reflects in a quite radical way the implications of this change, which also lead to a considerable transformation of fortune's role. The consequences of the transformation of traditional dogma in scholastic philosophy and theology at first come to light in Boccaccio's tacit rejection of the traditional explication of man's mortality. According to Christian dogma, human mortality is a result of punishment. It is punishment for man's resistance to God's will in the Garden of Eden. But no trace of this traditional argument is to be found in the De Camerone. In its Proemio, Boccaccio relates how, from his early youth, he suffered from an unbridled love which he was unable to control. Perciò che della mia prima giovinezza, infino a questo tempo, oltremodo essendo acceso stato d'altissimo e nobile amore, forse più assai che alla mia bassa condizione non parrebbe, narrandolo si richiedesse quantunque a poco loro che discreti erano e alla cui notizia pervenne io ne fossi lodato, era molto più reputato. Non di meno mi fu egli di grandissima fatica a sofferire, certo non per crudeltà della donna amata, ma per soverchio fuoco nella mente concetto da poco regolato appetito, il quale, perciò che a niuno convenevole termine mi lasciava un tempo stare, più di noia che bisogno non mi era spesse volte sentirmi faccia nella qual noia tanto refrigerio già mi porsero i piacevoli ragionamenti d'alcun amico, le sue lodevoli consolazioni, che io porto fermissima opinione per quelle essere avvenute che io non sia morto. Telling stories as a strategy of survival, this might appear an almost hyperbolic exaggeration. But Boccaccio's comment in what follows does not allow for any substantial doubt. Ma sì, come a colui piacque, il quale, essendo egli infinito, diede per legge incommutabile a tutte le cose mondane aver fine il mio amore, oltre ogni altro fervente, e il quale in una forza di proponimento, di consiglio, di vergogna evidente o pericolo che seguirne potesse, aveva potuto né rompere né piegare, per sé medesimo in processo di tempo si diminuì in guisa che sol di sé nella mente ma al presente lasciato quel piacere che gli è usato di porgere a chi troppo non si mette nei suoi più cupi pelaghi navigando. Erotic desire here appears in all its destructive force. It is above all the powerlessness of reason, its loss of control over love, which causes the insuperable strength of Boccaccio's erotic effect. The specific character of his loves follows not least from its end, for in spite of its intensity, it unexpectedly ends without any discernible reason. The term appetito, poco regolato appetito, serves as a key used by Thomas Aquinas to denote the basic stimulus of all human behavior. In scholastic theology, as well as in previous Christian teaching, the categorical loss of reason's control over the appetitus sensitivus is the critical consequence of original sin. The insurmountable weakness of will, volui nec potui, as Augustine puts it, is a classical symptom of the condition of fallen man. Therefore, Boccaccio's description of his invincible love at first sight might seem to be nothing else than a quite traditional account of his involvement in original sin. Yet his self-portrait rather challenges the traditional concept of original sin. As the Christian dogma clearly states, human mortality constitutes a form of punishment. It originates from God's response to man's disobedience. But no trace of the traditional argument is to be found in the lines quoted. Ma sì come a colui qua piacque, il quale, essendo egli infinito, diede per legge incommutabile a tutte le cose mondane aver fine. As he pleased, the finitude of human life and all earthly things seems to be not more than a caprice of the Creator, who, being himself infinite, liked his creatures to be finite. But the Creator's whim demonstrates at the same time his immense power. The difference between infinity and mortality establishes God's unconditional superiority. No longer punishment for sin has to motivate man's death, but his mortality is part of the very order of creation. On further consideration, Boccaccio's description of the Creator's whim even puts into question any possibility of salvation. If God decided that finitude should be the legge incommutabile, the invariable law of men, one might ask if this invariability does not exclude from the very beginning all salvation and guarantee of eternal life. Reason's loss of control over emotions, over the appetitus sensitivus, was in traditional theology the most significant symptom of the status naturae lapsae of fallen men. In Boccaccio's world, however, the weakness of will is no longer a consequence of original sin, but a natural part of conditio humana. The loss of rational control constitutes no longer a threat of eternal punishment. It is much more a danger for physical life. It is this naturalization of man's living conditions after his fall that brings about a critical change in the role of fortune, in which the dialectical consequences of Dante's integration of fortuna into the cosmological order come to light. If telling stories helps to prevent from death in existential love sickness, women much more than men deserve the author's attention. As men have much more opportunities for diversion in their life, women are much more in need of pleasant stories to overcome life-dangering love, which reason is unable to control. In this sense, Boccaccio significantly presents his book as a correction of fortune. Adunque, a ciò che in parte permessa mendi il peccato della fortuna, la quale dove meno era di forzi, su come noi nelle delicate donne veggiamo, qui vi più avara fu di sostegno, in quel soccorso rifugio di quelle che amano perciò che alle altre assai l'ago il fuso e l'arculaio. Intendo di raccontare 100 novelle o favole, parabole o storie che dire ne vogliamo, raccontate in 10 giorni da un'onesta brigata di 7 donne e di 3 giovani, nel pestilenzioso tempo della passata mortalità fatta, e alcune canzonette delle predette donne cantate al loro diletto. A ciò che in parte permessa mendi il peccato della fortuna. Especially the term peccato deserves our attention, as peccato does not only mean fall, but also, and even much more frequently, sin. Once again, the relation between God and fortune is at stake. Does Boccaccio follow a more traditional view and understand fortuna as a figure whose relation to God deliberately remains somewhat vague? Or does he follow Dante's redefinition of fortuna as a ministra dei who is fully integrated into the cosmological order? Boccaccio's use of the term peccato with regard to fortune seems to suggest that he pays tribute to a more traditional view. Yet a closer reading of the lines quoted reveals that he largely adopts Dante's integration of fortune into the order of creation. And this is, as we shall see, what makes his use of peccato almost revolutionary. As it occurs so frequently in Boccaccio's Decamerone, a seemingly negligible detail of his text in this connection proves remarkably momentous, namely Boccaccio's use of grammatical tense. Why does he describe fortune's behavior in the past tense? Usually, as Dante did also, fortune's actions are described in present tense, for her nature is not subject to change. She always acts as she is used to do, as she did in the past, and will continue to do in the future. Strikingly, in Boccaccio's text, this is not the case. A closer look on Boccaccio's account of her behavior might help to explain this difference. Obviously, fortune's acting constitutes a response, a reaction, as it is said about her, la quale dove mena era di forzo, sì come noi nelle delicate donne vediamo quivi più avara fu di sostegno. Fortuna adds something to something that exists already. Boccaccio's text even allows for a more precise definition of the nature of her additional gifts. The weakness of women seems to be part of her natural endowment, whereas her living conditions, as the text describes them, are based on cultural and social practices that do not necessarily follow from their natural qualities. Consequently, fortune continues to be responsible for the external goods. She adds contingent qualities to substantial natural endowment, but unlike the traditional figure of fortune, she does so once and for all. Once and for all, she determines the living conditions of man. In other words, she takes part in the process of creation. As in the case of Dante's Inferno, fortuna is fully integrated into the order of creation, but this order itself now proves quite precarious. Human deficiencies are no longer based on the illusions of a human mind, which is incapable to recognize the deeper reasons of fortune's disposal on behalf of God. The deficits of human existence now are factual deficiencies. They are peccati that call for correction. Creation is no longer designed for the universal benefit of man. God himself, on the contrary, begins to adopt the traditional qualities of fortune. Dante's integration of fortune into the order of cosmology dialectically leads to a corruption of the very creation. Probably the climax in this process of redefining the relationship between God and fortune is to be found in Machiavelli's Principe. One of the most famous chapters of this treatise is devoted to a discussion of the nature of fortune. Machiavelli's scathing analysis uncompromisingly brings to light the consequences which result from the tacit identification of God and Fortuna, which is implied in Dante's Inferno, and the consequences of which Boccaccio's Decamerone began to unfold. The respective chapter, the 25th of Machiavelli's Prince, starts off from the uncertainty about the relation between God and fortune. Enum è incognito, come molti hanno avuto e hanno opinione, che le cose del mondo siano in modo governate dalla fortuna e da Dio, che gli uomini con la prudenza loro non possano correggerle, anzi non vi abbiano rimedio alcuno. E per questo potrebbero giudicare che non fossi da insudare molto nelle cose, ma lasciarsi governare alla sorte. Governate dalla fortuna e da Dio. A simple juxtaposition of both transcendent powers characterizes the relation between fortune and God. Nothing is said about how they interact, about their difference or identity. This is at least the impression which the beginning of this chapter makes at first sight. However, on closer consideration, the reader will remark that Machiavelli quite precisely describes the relation between them, and he does so in a way which is in apparent contradiction with all what tradition had to say. Yet given the explosive nature of his redefinition of the relation between God and fortune, Machiavelli probably was wise to conceal his radical view in the implications of his argument. The central issue of the first sentence of chapter 25 of Machiavelli's Principe is not a definition of the relation between God and fortune. The nature of their relationship comes to light rather by implication. Explicitly, Machiavelli rather comments on a widespread opinion according to which man has no control over his actions. Opposing this claim, he firmly insists on man's power over fortune. The critical argument he brings forward to support his optimism deserves our particular attention. Non di manco, perché il nostro libero arbitrio non sia spento, giudico poter essere vero che la fortuna sia arbitra della metà delle azioni nostre, ma etiam, che etiam lei ne lasci governare l'altra metà oppresso a noi. According to Machiavelli, it is the free will which enables men to compete with fortune. Yet, consequently, as a precondition of man's agency, Machiavelli has to claim a self-confinement of fortune, who seems to be willing to cede about half of her power to men. Lei mi lasci governare, she allows us to govern ourselves. However, as an advocate of men's liberum arbitrium, fortune plays a role which is rather incompatible with her traditional portrait. Either she had been a ministra Dei who fulfilled God's will by her rule over human fate, or she acted as a capricious lady whose despotism constitutes a constant threat to men. In neither case, she has a specific interest in the preservation of men's free will. The liberum arbitrium, God's generous gift to his favorite earthly creature, rather determines the relationship between men and his grateful creator. To make men accountable for his actions, he needs the freedom to decide and to carry out his decisions. Only on the ground of such freedom, the distinction between good and evil for his acting becomes possible. Of course, to determine how precisely God's omnipotence relates to human free will is one of the most precarious questions of Christian theology. With good reasons, any rational solution of this problem has been challenged. Nonetheless, the supposition of mens liberum arbitrium is not only necessary to preserve his privileged position in the hierarchy of creation, man's free will is also a critical argument of theodicy. Solely with the help of his liberum arbitrium, man can be credited with troubling the initial order of creation. Only the possibility of his resistance to God's commands allows to interpret the deficiencies of nature in the fallen world as a result of God's punishment of man for his lack of obedience. To justify God, man's free will is indispensable. Nobody else than God himself, therefore, is interested in granting man his liberum arbitrium. It is him and not fortune who deliberately cedes for his own sake part of his agency to man. This is why in chapter 26 of his Prince, Machiavelli will unequivocally state that nobody else than God himself is responsible for man's free will. Dio non vuole fare ogni cosa per non ci torre il libero arbitrio e parte di quella gloria che tocca a noi. The initial juxtaposition of God and fortune, whose relationship to one another seemed to be largely indeterminate, on closer consideration proves nothing else than a mask of Machiavelli's tacit identification of both. And by crediting fortune with an interest in the preservation of man's free will, he implicitly reveals their basic identity. If the abolishment of any difference between them, however, comes to light only by implication, its latency conclusively results from its subversive effects. For free will, too, undergoes a momentous transformation. From a guarantee of man's freedom, it turns to an instrument of man's power in his ongoing struggle with fortune, in his permanent combat against Fortuna, whom it became difficult to distinguish from God himself. Freedom, the possibility to exert one's free will, now much more seems to be the reward for a victorious fight than the gift of a generous creator. And fortune, alias God himself, is the opponent in this never-ending war. Ed assomiglio quella a uno di questi fiumi rovinosi che quando s'adirano allagano, you see the topicality of the argument, allagano I piani, ruinano I alberi e gli edifici, levano da questa parte terreno, pongono da quell'altra, ciascuno fugge loro dinanzi, ognuno cede allo impeto loro senza poter in alcuna parte obstare. E benché siano così fatti, non resta però che gli uomini, quando sono tempi quieti, non vi potessino fare provvedimenti, e con ripari ed argini, in modo che crescendo poi, o andrebbero per uno canale, o l'impeto loro non sarebbe né si licenzioso, né si dannoso. Similmente interviene dalla fortuna, la quale dimostra la sua potenza dove non è ordinata virtù a resistere, e quivi volta i suoi impeti là dove la sa che non sono fatti gli argini e li ripari a tenerla. The destructive river, alias fortune, requires human precautions against her pernicious work. Interestingly, in this connection, Machiavelli says that the rivers have been made to exert their destructive power, e benché siano così fatti, but have been made equals have been created. Once again, in the guise of the pernicious power of nature, the threatening power of its creator becomes visible, whose creation does not seem to have been designed for the benefit of man. On the contrary, nature is life endangering. The price to pay for Dante's naturalization of fortune, of her complete integration into a Christian cosmology as an instrument of God's will, is high. God himself eventually adopts the qualities of fortune. Under these conditions, the resistance to God, by which all history once commenced in the Garden of Eden, no longer appears to be a sacrilege that calls for severe reprisals, but man's self-assertion becomes a necessity for survival in a life-endangering creation, for creation as a whole becomes the realm of fortune. Thank you very much for your attention.